Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome everybody to Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and tonight we're dealing with trust law and setting up your estate. Now, we'll be dealing with answering the following questions. Which is better, a trust or a will? What type of trust should you set up? When would you need a will? Why should you set up an estate? What are the basics for setting up a trust? What part of being a secured party creditor play in all of this? What is the declaration of trust? Before we get down into this stuff, we're going to, first of all, I want to say give a shout out to my students in our new class, and we're dealing with trust, we're dealing with secured party creditor, we're dealing with the public, the whole nine, and I would like to commend them at the progress they're making, and just give a shout out to you. We will be going into questions, and when we come back, we'll get down on into this broadcast. But let me start off by saying Dr. Williams will be back with us by the end of this month. We had a few technical difficulties, but right now, hopefully, we've ironed all these things out. So let me go on to the commercials, and when we come back, we'll be ready to roll, okay? We'll just hold on a minute, and we'll be right back.
What a fantastic way to live. Hello, I'm Tahaka Amana L. Bay, operating in the private as a secured party and creditor instead of living the life of a debtor. Now, to learn how to do that, you have to get the knowledge. There's no doubt about it. You don't mix public with private, just like oil and water don't mix. For the skill and know-how, go to www.TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Contact me, Tahaka. My number is on the website. Or send me an email. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Learn how to live the good life as a secured party and a creditor instead of a debtor. And eliminate your debts. Fun time is almost over. TahakaDebtElimination.org. Peace. Credit card debt, student loan debt, lawsuits, child support, mortgages, foreclosure, secured party and creditor. Get my free report. Go to www.TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. What kind of trust do you set up? How do you use a trust? What do you put in a trust? For the solution, contact me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. Get my free report by going to TahakaDebtElimination.org. Driver's license, freedom to travel. Who exactly needs the driver's license? What did the U.S. Supreme Court rule about it over and over again? How does that work? What is proper syntax grammar? Get my free report. Go to TahokaDataElimination.org. Fill out the little contact form. Put your email address in there. That'll come straight to me, and I'll rush it directly to your email. TahokaDataElimination.org. Real estate is booming today. But one thing I learned a long time ago about mortgages and foreclosures, the real estate market goes in cycles, up and down. The best thing to do is get out of that type of situation early. The U.S. corporation is still operating in a bankrupt state today. Make no mistake about it. When it comes to your home, the bank has no skin in the game. When you sign for your home, it was paid for. Learn how to do that. The IRS is a private-for-profit corporation. Learn how to deal with that. Go to TahokaDebtElimination.org. That's TahokaDebtElimination.org. How do you discharge debt? How do you write it up? What do you do? Learn how to do that. Contact me, Tahaka Amanuel Bey. Go to TahokaDebtElimination.org. Peace.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Now, the first thing that I want to deal with here is, let's see here. What type of trust should you set? Now, me personally, I always recommend a irrevocable common law trust, but we got a revocable common law trust, and people have to decide which trust they're going to take. I believe in operating in the private when you come to a trust, putting your assets in the trust. And because we've had some situations, and we're going to go to this, and I'm going to let you get some, we got a plug I want you to listen to, involving some of the most people, some of the people that you would think that really had this thing in a bag, but who really didn't. And so we want to take a look at it and make sure that we're not a victim of the same type of circumstances. So y'all hold on a minute.
Hey, estate planning attorney Paul Rabelais here. And in this video, we're going to talk about five specific duties that a trustee of a trust has. So, you know, I get asked questions like this all the time. You know, somebody comes in, they say, Paul, I got a question I need to ask. I'm involved in a trust. I'm a beneficiary of a trust. And so-and-so is the trustee. So-and-so might be the beneficiaries, mother, stepmother, stepfather, father, cousin, aunt, uncle, brother, corporate trustee. And so they'll say, you know, Paul, let me tell you what the trustee did. They did this, and then Paul, can they do that? So this addresses those trustee duties and again, you know, what duties a trustee of a trust have. Now, a couple of things at the outset. Many trust instruments define what the trustee duties are. There's likely to be a section in the trust instrument that defines what what the duties of the trustee are, and that section might be a page long, or it might be 30 pages long. Or in absence of specific trustee duties in the trust instrument, then you have to look to the trust law to define what those trustee duties are. Some trusts will have language that says the trustee is bound by the duties that are defined in the applicable trust law. So you have to look at all of that. Now, I will say that provisions in a trust that limit a trustee's duty of loyalty to the beneficiary are typically ineffective. Couple of other points. And as I go through these examples, know that these trustee duties generally don't apply when someone has a revocable trust. A lot of trusts out there where the person setting up the trust, they transfer assets to their trust. They are the trustee. The trust is revocable. A lot of these trustee duties don't apply to that trustee of a revocable trust because, quite frankly, the trustee, who is also the settlor, can revoke their trust, put everything back in their name. So there really are no duties to others that the trustee of a revocable living trust has. But nonetheless, Let me go through, and so in fact, let me go over maybe a couple of scenarios where these duties do apply. So oftentimes, maybe grandfather either left as a bequest assets to a trust, let's say for his grandchildren, and grandfather named his son as the trustee of that trust, and the grandchildren are adults. So the son is going to have a duty that we'll talk about here in a minute to preserve assets for the benefit of the grandfather's grandchildren, and we'll talk about what those duties are. Another common example is when a husband, for example, leaves his estate when he dies to a trust for perhaps his wife for her lifetime, and then perhaps when his wife dies back to his children, and his wife, his surviving wife, may or may not be the mother of his children. So whoever the trustee of that trust is must abide by the duties that I'm about to talk about here in a moment. And that trustee of that trust might be his surviving wife, might be one or more of his children, might be some other third party, might be a corporate trustee, but they're bound by these duties. So let me go through five particular duties that a trustee of a trust has. The first one I'm going to talk about is a loan. And our trust law is specific that says an individual trustee shall not lend funds to himself, his relative, employer, employee, partner, or business associate unless the trust instrument provides otherwise. So if you're the trustee of a trust and there's $1 million in the trust, you can't just say, you know what, boy, I could use maybe $500,000 loan, pay off some debts, I'll get around to paying that back to the trust when I get around to it. Can't do that. The only way you can, as trustee, you can personally borrow money from the trust is if the trust instrument provides it. And because you have a duty of loyalty to the beneficiary, if you're going to do that, because the trust instrument provides it, it better be an arm's length transaction, you know, appropriate collateral, interest rate, that kind of thing. So really, it's frowned upon loans by a trustee from the trust. Number two is a sale. And so again, an individual trustee shall not directly or indirectly buy or sell property for the trust from or to himself or all those other people, his relative, employer, employee, business associate, and partner, unless the trust instrument provides otherwise or it's authorized by a court. Now you see this one apply from time to time. And a common example is mom and dad die, they had a trust. They both passed away. They have four children. They leave the trust assets to the four children equally. Oldest child is the trustee of that trust now that mom and dad have passed away. And let's say oldest child says, I'd like to buy mom and dad's house from the trust. And so perhaps either trust law or the trust instrument may prohibit that. If it does, then I think what's oldest son would have to do is he would have to distribute or transfer that home from the trust to the four children so that the four children would be co-owners, and then oldest child could purchase each of his siblings 1/4 interest from that sibling of his. So that might be the way to kind of get around the I can't buy property from the trust provision. Trust duty number three, the accounting requirements. This requirement is almost never met by individual trustees. So a trustee has a duty to keep and render clear and accurate accounts of the administration of the trust. And at least once a year, that trustee must render a clear and accurate account covering his administration for the previous year. So I've had people come into the office, Paul, I'm a beneficiary of a trust, and my brother is the trustee. I haven't heard from him in 7 years. I don't know what he's doing. He probably squandered the trust, blah, 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 cry me a river. I'm like, man, 7 years and you haven't heard a word? What are you doing waiting 7 years to look into getting information about this trust that, you know, you are involved in? So be aware of that. A lot of individual trustees aren't even aware that they have this accounting requirement. So hopefully this video will make both trustees and beneficiaries aware of the trustee accounting requirement. Trustee duty number four, the duty to furnish information. So the last one was about an annual accounting, and so this one is a trustee shall give to a beneficiary upon his request, and I'm going to refer to the actual provision of our trust code. Let's see. Drop the old scotch tape. A trustee shall give to a beneficiary upon his request at reasonable times complete and accurate information as to the nature and amount of the trust property and permit him or a person duly authorized by him to inspect the subject matter of the trust and the accounts, vouchers, and other documents relating to the trust. So again, another scenario where if you haven't heard from that trustee in, let's call it years, you can require request at reasonable times all of that, you know, information that you as a beneficiary would like to have from the trust, all of the accounts, all of the statements. Now, so if you haven't heard from the trustee in, 3 years, I would say you're contacting the trustee and saying, I'd like to see a copy of all the accounts and other relevant information. I would say if you haven't heard from them in 3 years, that is a reasonable time to request that. Now, if you go every week and say, I want to see a printout of all the transactions every single week, that may not be reasonable, so it's kind of limited to this. That trustee shall give to a beneficiary upon his request at reasonable times complete and accurate information. And then number five, I'm going to refer to the trust code again. It's that just kind of that general prudent administration standard, because our legislatures, they can't legislate every single action that a trustee might take. So we have these fairly general prudent administration statutes that say a trustee shall administer the trust as a prudent person would administer it. In satisfying this standard, the trustee shall exercise reasonable care and skill considering the purposes, terms, distribution requirements, and other circumstances of the trust. So that provision basically says a trustee has a duty to do what a prudent trustee would do, because there's so many different things that a trustee could do. They can't legislate everyone, so they, of course, make sense that they would have this prudent administrator rule. Okay, there's a few other trustee duties, but those are the ones I get questions about the most. So here's the deal. If you have a question, if you are perhaps a beneficiary of some type of irrevocable trust, and you have a question as to what the trustee's duties are, I would, number one, look at the terms of the trust. And if you don't have a copy of the trust, shame on you, that might be the first thing you'll want to request, because every beneficiary is entitled to have a copy of the trust instrument. So number one, look at the terms of the trust instrument. Number two, if the trust instrument does not address what that trustee's duty is, or at least the one that you're inquiring about, then look to your state's trust law to see if your state's trust law addresses that particular trustee duty that you're inquiring about. So that ought to get you straight. And if you're at the point of questioning a trustee's duties, then you're probably going to want to be in the mode of making sure that you obtain the required annual accountings from the trustee. You may at other reasonable times want to request other information that would give you the peace of mind that hopefully that the trustee is performing as that trustee should, because they're bound by that prudent administration rule to do what a prudent trustee would do. So that gets you started on trustee duties. And the other thing that you want to do is really two things. One, smash the like button, turn it from gray to blue. That'll tell YouTube, show my video to more people. And then number two, if you haven't already, subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you don't miss any.
All right, everybody. Now, now that we got the outline for the duties of the people that's actually functioning in your trust, very important because I'm finding out today, and I was actually kind of shocked to discover after all the years that we've been teaching this stuff and been telling people this stuff, you still got people, Moorish people, and people of African descent across this nation that still haven't done anything. A lot of them don't even have a will. And it's guaranteed that one day we're going to leave this planet. There ain't no doubt about it. So I think this is something that we need to pay attention to. We need to get your insurance in order. You need to get your trust established, get your will, because there's certain things that you can put in a trust and certain things that you really don't have to unless you want to, but at least you should have them in a will. Now, when people do wills, you discover when a person does a will, 9 times out of 10, and from probate court. So this is why we're recommending you to establish your trust. And then there's a part about funding your trust and then there's taxation and all this stuff that goes along with it. But we're going to get down in a little bit more deeper down into this thing. And but in the meantime, we're going to take a little quick break. And we'll be right back in just a few minutes. And we'll come back, then we'll continue. So y'all,
your Social Security card is connected to an account, a trust at the Federal Reserve.
Okay. I think I went a little too deep there. Hold on a minute. We'll be right back. Y'all hold on. Okay? right, everybody. We're back. Let's get down into why it's so important for us to set up our estate and how to, why it's so important to function through a good living trust, okay? And let me start off by saying that for your guests, the number to dial into this broadcast is 605-9757. And now the phone lines will be open later on in the broadcast. Press your phone, that'll give me some indication that you have something to say, okay? But let's take a look at some of this stuff. Let me make sure I got it right here first.
Hi, guys. It's MJ, and in this video, I want to talk about trust. Now, trust, like a lot of things in finance, is a contract between various parties. But what...
This is it. Let me see.
Y'all can do all this renovation work, and you still can't call the estate planner that I connected you with?
See, we knew you were going to ask, so...
There you go.
Y'all wrote your will in pencil?
Well, I had to erase a few things because Jerome pissed me off.
Mom, Dad, this limp, loose leaf of paper does not qualify as estate planning. You actually have to go through lawyers.
After five seasons, Insecure on HBO left a remarkable impact as it captured the life of young black millennials figuring life out, including getting their aging parents to write a will. There has been an uptick in estate planning, arranging things like wills, trust, and power of attorney since we've entered a global pandemic. But according to a survey by Caring.com, black Americans are still less likely to have their estate planning documents in order compared to other racial and ethnic groups. Joining me now to discuss is estate planning attorney Portia Wood. Portia, so happy to have you here. Welcome to The Cross Connection. Now, when people hear estate planning, they immediately think of wealth, but it really encompasses so much more than that. So tell our viewers what else estate planning includes.
Absolutely. And Tiffany, can I just say thank you so much for having me on your show. Your voice is so impactful and necessary in our community. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Estate planning. Yeah, estate planning really is not just about what happens to your stuff after you're gone, but it's really about how you want to live and how you want the people who are left behind to continue to thrive off of your work. So when we think about estate planning, we're really thinking about that element, what happens while you're alive and then what happens to the people who are left behind.
So, but this is, I want to be specific with our viewers because some people say, well, I don't have wealth. I don't need to estate plan. And some people think, you know, telling the kids the money under the mattress and, you know, don't tell Uncle Jed about, you know, what happened in 1985. Mm-hmm. And that's not really estate planning. So it seems right. Like, you know, your end of life plans, or do you want to, you know, is it a do not resuscitate plan? Is it finances? So what are some specific things that people should consider when planning their estate?
Yeah, so everybody over the age of 18 needs an estate plan, and there's three basic components, right? The first is going to be your property power of attorney. It's the legal document that allows someone to access your bank accounts, to pay your bills, to make decisions for you if you can't do it. We're coming out of a global pandemic, and so people are top of mind of what happens if I'm in the hospital. That's going to be your property power of attorney. The second is going to be your healthcare document. That's your healthcare power of attorney. It's your advanced healthcare directive that says what you would want to have happen. And it's your HIPAA authorization form. And the third piece that everybody over the age of 18 needs is a distribution plan. What happens to everything you have after you're gone? And that distribution plan is what most people think estate planning is. They think it's, that's it, but it encompasses all of these other pieces. The distribution plan is, do you need a will? Do you need a trust? And I'm here to tell you, most people probably would benefit from a trust-based structure versus a will, because a will still needs to go through probate court, which can be expensive and time-consuming.
Yeah, and, you know, something else, a lot of divorces during COVID. The saying was you can't spell divorce without COVID. And something that I found surprising, if there is no will, there are times where an ex-spouse can have access to your money. So I think a lot of times in black families, we think, well, who's going to cook at the repast? And we need to think about our finances, even if you don't have any, if there's a house, you know, that you want, or items that you want. So why do you think, though, that in our community, in black communities, people are not as prepared in reference to our counterparts?
Estate planning wasn't built for us, right? It's a game that we didn't have the rules to for centuries, that we were actually actively kept out of. And then throughout the generations, people took advantage of our lack of knowledge in this space, right? We think about, you know, the mortgage crisis that came out in subprime mortgages. All of that plays into why the older generation doesn't want to do estate planning. There's a lack of trust. There's a lack of education. There's a lack of information. And so what we're working on is, how do we get more culturally competent advisors who understand the history so that they can effectively guide our community through this process? And the problem is, there just aren't that many people. And so instead of going out there and risking doing it wrong, they sort of wait, they procrastinate, and they say, it'll get worked out somehow down the road. And it just doesn't. That's not how it works.
What do you think is the most common thing that people don't think about? I have started my own estate planning and speaking with lawyers the past few weeks, and things, the questions that I was asked, you know, something like social media passwords, you know, just ways that people can help transition. And again, this is something people don't like to talk about, but it's a very necessary discussion. So something that people might not be thinking about when they're going through this process, and what should they look for in an estate planner?
Yeah, so that's really great questions, right? The first is going to be, who are your beneficiaries? What do you want them to have, and why? Why do you want to do this? If your kids have student loan debt because they've gotten, you know, higher education, then you may want to leave any assets that you're giving them differently, because you might not want to impact their income-based repayment. You may have beneficiaries who have been, had contacts with the incarceral system, and so maybe they have restitution issues or back child support, and so what you leave them, you're going to want to leave in a protected way that the state isn't going to put judgments on that. Lots of people aren't thinking about those issues when they're talking about estate planning. They're just saying, oh, I want to make sure this gets to this kid, but there's so much more to preserving everything that we've worked for, especially in our community when it is complicated. We have lots of blended families in our community, some families that are built by love. We have grandparents who are raising grandchildren. They are not accounted for under the law. And so we have to create comprehensive estate plans to make sure our wishes are honored. And so all of those are questions that need to be thought about as we go along.
I think this is such a necessary conversation, Portia, and I don't think this is the last time we'll talk about it, because there are even, you know, other things like, should your family member be the executive of your estate, and, you know, things that I know that I've been unpacking the past few weeks. So thank you so much for giving this very difficult conversation some very necessary guidance and knowledge. Thank you, Portia Wood. You'll definitely be back on the Cross Connection. Glad to have you.
Okay. Now we're back. Now, I'm going to get to the point about the people, you know, why it is so important for you to do your estate and your estate plan and put everything in order. It's pretty much simple, because if you know that you move into the war at the end of your days and stuff, you got your credit cards, you got your debit cards, you got your bank accounts, you got your insurance policies and all this stuff. And why not write up a list and say, well, okay, I got, let's say, $10,000 in Bank of America. You can access these funds by this particular credit card or debit card. And here's the PIN number to the debit card. Have the debit card, the debit cards, the credit cards listed, and make sure that this is passed on to beneficiaries. Your insurance policy, who is the beneficiary, what insurance company are you dealing with, who is the beneficiaries to handle that insurance, and the actual location of the policy, so these people can go straight to that. Now, all of this information should be put in your trust. This stuff should be listed right there in your trust. We're going to take a little quick commercial break, And we'll be right back. So y'all hold on a minute, okay?
Hi, I'm Tahaka. By January the 26th or 28th, 2022, the U.S. government corporation will begin calling for full payment of student loan debt again. The pause will be over. Don't wait until the last minute. Get out of debt now. You have plenty of time now. Go to www.TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. It's just like someone filing bankruptcy. After you have filed and the deadline arrives, you still owe the debt. It's a scam. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. Contact me, Tahaka, for what you need to solve the problem. Peace. Don't wait. Act now.
Okay. Now, funding your trust. But before we get into that, let's go back and deal with this thing about I know a lot of people have heard about it a lot, black wealth, and I'm going to get into some, I got some documents here and stuff. I'm going to run over a few things with it, especially in regards to the question about what part of being a secure party creditor play in this. Now, just think for a minute. You got your trust set up. You're the grantor of your trust. We'll say that you have a bare minimum of two trustees. And then we got a trust manager, we got a secretary, and then we got the beneficiaries. And keep in mind that everybody in the trust has a treasury account. So if you are the grantor of the trust and you become a secure party and a creditor, and you've accessed your direct treasury account throughout the entire trust, because you got the framework for the trust set up right there. But if everybody else is on board and they're learning how to do the same thing, amount of power of everybody put their functioning as a good power trust. Okay? But let's take a look at this thing. Losing black wealth. So y'all hold on.
What's up, good people? What's happening? It's the poor black man. I uploaded the wrong video and I decided to just do a whole new video. We're talking about estate planning and how we lose so much money when we fail to plan for death. I read that around 70% of black people die without any form of an estate plan, no will, nothing. Around 70%. And some of the people we know, Aretha Franklin died without a will, Prince died without a will or a trust, John Singleton died without anything set up. And the list goes on. The list goes on. All these talks about generational wealth. That's all I've been hearing people talk about. Generational wealth. Generational wealth. Generational wealth. Well, how are you going to pass down the assets that you have acquired and worked so hard for to the next generation if you do not have an estate plan? How does that happen? Probate court is expensive. The cost, they are going to come from your, it's going to come from your estate. Probate court is expensive. There's an article that I posted the link to where the mother purchased a house in Chicago. She also had a PhD. She was a professor. Checked off all the boxes. Did everything the right way. Raised her kids. You name it. But she never sat down to set up an estate plan. And when she passed away, her property went to probate. And after probate, her children were left with $40,000. The house was sold. And the people who purchased the house, they did minor upgrades and resold the house for a significant gain. So this is not just about people being financially literate. We're literally talking about somebody with a doctorate. We are talking about celebrities who are worth millions. Aretha Franklin, Prince, but they did not have an estate plan set up. So I'm asking you, why don't you have one set up? Why don't we do this? When I was setting up my estate plan, and I'm not married, but I had to sit down with my son's mother, and she did not like that conversation because she felt like something was about to happen to me and I wasn't telling her. And she got emotional. She said, are you safe? Is there something that you need to tell me? And I said, no, I'm fine. I am supposed to plan my estate when I'm healthy, not when I'm about to die. I'm supposed to plan my estate when I am in good health, when I am coherent. That's one of the ways we avoid people challenging this estate plan, people challenging the will. Was it developed in duress? In duress. Was this signature forged? Grandma is 90 years old and all of a sudden she has a new will and estate plan. Don't you think somebody is going to take that up and challenge that in court if they don't get anything from grandma? It happens all the time. We cannot talk about money and generational wealth if we don't start taking estate planning serious. This is not about if you have money or not. Everybody needs to take this serious. Because even if you only have a wardrobe, you need to make sure that that goes where you want it to go. That could be, you know, it all it takes is something as simple as a typed up document or a handwritten note, something that you get notarized and you make copies of and you give it out to your family and friends. That's something is better than nothing. But if you have the time and you have the means, set up your estate plan. You can download the documents and do it yourself. It just has to be notarized. If you're doing a trust, I believe that has to be filed with the county. My trust is on file. Everything that I own is in my trust. I have a revocable trust. And going back to my son's mother, I quizzed her. Every now and then I quiz her on, you know, what do you do if something happens to me? Where are all the passwords? What color is the folder? You know, she knows where everything is, and I quiz her from time to time. Let me ask you this. You have cryptocurrency, right? If you have cryptocurrency, how is your family going to access your cryptocurrency? How are they going to get into your Coinbase? What's the password? Do you have the keys? If you're storing your crypto, if you do cold storage, how are they going to access that? You died with $1 million worth of Bitcoin, and now your family can't get to it. Do we think about these things? So my challenge is for anybody watching this video, if you're black, white, Asian, whatever, my challenge is for you to take this serious and maybe have that conversation today or tomorrow if you are married. Hey, babe. We need to set up some sort of trust. What's up with our estate plan? What's going to happen if we die tomorrow? How are we going to make sure that our children are cared for? If all you have is $25,000 worth of assets, the last thing you want is $15,000 to go to a lawyer. You really want to avoid a court battle over your assets. And so I'll leave you with this. If you take my advice and you go talk to your spouse or your family or your mother or grandparents and talk about setting up an estate plan, it should not be about what's coming to you. It should be about them having a plan. They can develop it without you being in the room with a neutral party, as long as they're in good health and coherent, because there is an ugly side to estate planning as well. And the ugly side is you not wanting, or the family member knowing that they don't want to give money to a certain person. They don't want to leave money to a certain person, and they don't want that person to know while they're alive. So maybe they have something, maybe they have a plan, and maybe they don't want you to see it because you ain't getting anything. That money has been known to destroy families, to destroy friendships. Money that you didn't work for, money that you feel like you are entitled to, and because you didn't get what you felt like you deserved from Big Mama, you feeling real salty about the people who did get some money. That is the ugly side. Because people feel entitled to what their parents has built, what their parents built. And the reality is, some of you guys have experienced this firsthand. Some of you have experienced this firsthand where somebody passed away and they didn't leave you anything, and you felt some type of way about it. We'll call that the ugly side of estate planning, because whatever they decide they want to do with their assets is up to them. What I want for black people to take this seriously, so whatever we build, we can continue to build upon, not lose. Whatever we build, we can continue to build upon. You cannot talk about generational wealth without setting up a proper plan to transfer that wealth when you die. And we will die, all of us. This is the Poor Black Man. I respect your time. I respect your intelligence. I will see you guys on the next one. Set up that.
All right, everybody. We back. Now, one other thing that you might want to consider. Think about who's getting what. You want to consider using your durable power of documents and making sure that you are installing the proper person that is going to designate where your assets are going. You're going to give them power of attorney. I've already got a durable power of attorney. I'm not going to read it. It simply says if you become disabled or incompetent. Okay, that's all I'm going to read there. Know about persons present that John Doe, 1234 Jackson Street, Jacksonville, Florida, 32207. This durable power of attorney, and do hereby make constitute an appointment to Hawker Monterey Bay, P.O. Box 9686, Jacksonville, Florida, 32209. Agent or attorney in fact, as may attorney in fact to in any way which I myself could do, as if I am permitted by law to act agent pursuant to the following provisions. This is to be construed and interpreted as a general durable power of attorney effective immediately. This power of attorney shall not be affected by disability, incompetency, or incapacity of the principal. Okay, that's all I'm going to do on. I wanted to add that. your assets and the trust, and you may have some pretty large assets, and you want to be specific about who handles that asset. And when you do have a power of attorney, it could be added to your trust, and then there are certain things that you can not add it in the trust, and then you can take the will and add it to the trust. Now, these are some little points I wanted to point out to you, things that you can do involving establishing your estate and making sure that your estate is ready to go. Critique it. Make sure that everybody's in place. Make sure that everybody gets what exactly you want. Basically, laying this stuff out while you're living. See, I used to always tell people, you don't wait for water to break ammunition. It's time for you to start drawing up what you want to go where. What a complete accounts, your houses, your cars, your TVs, your radio, your stereos, your air conditioners, your air purifiers, water purifiers, whatever it is that that you want, you own, you want this stuff designated to your beneficiaries, and have this thing listed up and tuned to make sure that everybody clearly understands this is for you right here. This is your one. This house belongs to you. This car belongs to you, and so on and so forth. Put a house in a trust. Okay, we're going to take a look at.
Why did the young boy have trust issues growing up? Because his father didn't leave him one.
What?
Okay, let's talk about it. How to set up a trust fund. It's something that is actually very easy and frankly something that I think everyone should be doing. But there are some key things that you need to make sure you include so that you cover as many bases as you possibly can when you're setting up a trust fund. So in this video, I'm going to give you everything that I think you need to know when it comes to establishing a trust fund. Stay tuned. All right, so let's get started by answering the question, why should you start a trust fund? So as the great Benjamin Franklin once said, the only things that are certain in life are death and taxes. And I know, right? Like death can be a sour subject to talk about, but it's necessary today to really bring home the message of why and how to establish a trust fund. Because some people think that only rich people and wealthy people are the ones that need to set up a trust fund, and it's not something they think they need to worry about. But listen, I don't care whether or not you have $1 million or $10,000, okay? When you die, you can't take it with you. And someone's actually going to want your money or your assets when you pass away. So you want to leave this world as organized and as clean as possible. Because if you don't, then you are risking your family and your friends fighting over you and your assets, especially during an intense time where they're already grieving or they should be celebrating your life. So I don't know about you, but I would like to be the reason that my family and my friends become closer together instead of them moving further apart, especially in a time period of my death. Okay, so number two, what is a trust fund? So you probably guessed it by now, but a trust fund is basically a document that decides what happens to your assets and your personal property after you pass away. So what I want you to do is to really think about everything that you own, especially for the people who are already thinking like, I don't need a trust fund, okay? What happens to your car? What happens to the equity in your home? Okay, what happens to the bank accounts, your retirement accounts where you have money in? Heck, what even happens to your devices like your computers, your tablets, your iPhones, anything else you have? You know, I don't know, but basically when you set up a revocable living trust, You get to decide what happens to your property when you are no longer here, okay? You can give your property to your children. You can donate it to a nonprofit. You can give it to a close friend or a mentor that really impacted your life, a cousin, a nephew, whoever you want to. The point is you get to decide and you should. Now, on the opposite side, right? Like what happens if you don't have a trust fund or a will? Well, the state where you reside gets to decide how your property is distributed. So essentially, you give all the control to the state. And in most cases, your assets are distributed to your heirs, so your spouse, your children, parents, siblings, nieces, nephews, etc. Now, of course, this is a little bit problematic. For example, maybe your spouse think they deserve more than your close brother. And that, of course, can drive a rift between your loved ones. So with that, we want to make things very clear, right? We don't want to leave the decision to the state and have heated debates happen amongst our family and friends. Okay, so number three, let's talk about what terms can you put into your trust fund. But before I do, if you're new to our channel, welcome. I'm Sean with Life Accounting, the accounting company that saves people from high taxes and low profits. Of course, today we're not talking about how to save on taxes or increase profits, but we are teaching a very valuable subject to our audience. So if you're enjoying this video so far, please support us by hitting the like button for the YouTube algorithm. It really helps this video reach more people like you who want to learn how to establish a trust fund. And it just gives us the momentum to continue to create great content for YouTube. So have you done it yet? Yes? Okay, thank you so much. Now, let's go ahead and get into step number three. What terms can you put into your trust fund? So I'm going to make this very simple. You get to decide the terms of your revocable living trust. So what does that mean? Well, first off, you get to decide what the trust is a beneficiary of. For example, if you own a rental property and your rental property is inside of an LLC, well, you can make your trust a beneficiary of that LLC. Okay, but what else, right? Like, so you can make your trust fund a beneficiary of your primary home, your investment accounts such as your stocks, your gold, your crypto, if you're into that. Okay, your revocable living trust can be a beneficiary of your businesses, right? Or any of the side hustles or whatever else that you want. Okay, so that's the first step, is to decide what your trust is a beneficiary of. And that is essentially the process of funding your trust fund. Hey, Sean, look, I can have a trust fund too. Okay, wait a second, not that kind of fun. But you get the point, right? Like, you get to decide what assets you want the trust fund to be a beneficiary of. Now, after that, as we talked about already, you get to decide, okay, who do you want the assets to go to? Now, the cool thing is that you can establish under what terms someone gets your assets, okay? And this is my favorite part, right? Like, you get to be very creative, because here's the thing. You may want your son or your daughter to inherit your business, but you don't want them to get it at 19 years old, right? Like, they may make poor financial decisions and destroy that business. So with a revocable living trust, you can say, okay, here are the terms and conditions under which you will inherit this business. So for example, you could say, like, you have to be at least 30 years old. You must have went to college and earned your bachelor's degree or higher. And then number three, you have to have proof that you have watched 30 life accounting videos from start to finish, right? And like, okay, obviously that's just an example and I'm making up these terms, but the key takeaway here is that you get to decide. So as another example, let's say you have $100,000 worth of stocks and you want to give that away to your beneficiaries one day. So the conditions under which your beneficiary gets your stock can be something like, you must be at least 18 years old, okay? You must pass 4 randomized drug tests from this specific company. In this case, this can help you make sure that whoever's getting the money is actually responsible with it. And you can say something like, you must complete a year's worth of therapy and you can only use the money to start a business or to go to college, right? And these terms may give you extra confidence that you're giving your assets, your stocks, to your loved one, and they're also going to be responsible and carry on your legacy. All right, so again, you get to decide what terms and conditions that your assets are passed on. Now, the last thing you need to know about point number four is how to create the legal document. So the hard part is making some of the decisions in step number three, right? Which again is deciding which assets to put into your trust fund or the beneficiary of those funds, and then what are the terms under which those assets are distributed. Now the next thing, of course, is to tie all of this together by creating a legally binding document for your trust fund. Now when it comes to creating this document, you have two options. Now of course you can do it yourself, or you can hire an expert like an attorney. The pros and the cons of hiring an expert or doing it yourself are pretty obvious, right? It's all about whether or not you want to save yourself some money or save yourself some time. Of course, if you work with an attorney, they may be able to give you some tips and tricks that you won't be aware of even after hours of research. But you can still do it yourself using a website with templates like LawDepot.com or Nolo.com. All right, now moving right along to number five. Appoint a trustee. So the trustee is the person who will manage the trust. Now, as long as you are alive, you will be the trustee. However, when you die, the trustee is the person that you appoint for transferring the assets to your beneficiary. Okay, so typically the primary beneficiary, like your spouse or the oldest child, may be the trustee, and they will continue to manage the trust in your absence, making sure that the beneficiaries comply with all the trust terms and the assets are distributed properly. And the last point is point number six, which is to execute the trust. Now listen, you can do everything that we just mentioned, right? You can go through steps number one to number five. You can even create the legal document, but your trust is not in effect until it is executed. And to properly execute the trust, you must sign it in front of a public notary. And the notary should be also able to stamp it or sign off on the trust as well. Now, while you're at it, you should also sign the trust in front of a witness, and this person cannot be a beneficiary. All right, and this is just in case a legal argument arises and they don't have a bias, right? And then after that trust is officially executed, then bang, congratulations, you have established a trust fund. Now after that, or maybe even throughout this video, you may be asking yourself, what about a will? Like, do I need a will or a trust fund? And there are some big differences between a will and a trust. But one thing that they both have in common is they usually take effect after you die and help ensure your assets and possessions end up going where you want them to go. So if you want to see me make an in-depth video about trust funds versus a will, please tell me in the comment section below. But that is it for now. As always, thank you so, so much for watching. We have two more videos coming up next, so make sure you check those out if you haven't already. And I'll see you over there.
All right, everybody, we're back. Okay, we're back. Now, I asked a question earlier in the broadcast. People have asked, can I put my house in a trust? Well, let's take a close look at that before we do anything. Let's answer that question. And we're going to answer that. And keep in mind, the number to dial into the broadcast is 515. 606. Yep. 605-9757. 515-605-9757. Press 1 on the phone. That'll give me an indication that you got something to say, and we'll open up the phone line so you can come on in. And keep in mind that in the following weeks, we're going to be dealing with the stuff, trust in your state, your secure party creditor, living in the private versus the public. Because we got quite a few people that's gotten stuck out there on that thing, and we want to make sure that they're able to do this stuff successfully. Your freedom of rights to travel and stuff is still available to you, and we want to take a look at the structure of the United States of America Republic now, as well as the United States Corporation, and take a look at what these people are doing, because these people are still functioning in the private. They're still discharging their debt. They're still doing this stuff. This was never a fad. This is a permanent fissure. We're still operating in a bankrupt state, okay? Let's don't forget that. We're going to take a little quick break with a little music, and then we'll be right back. Hold your hat. The number to dial in the 9757, okay? Now, what we want to do now, as I mentioned to you earlier, that we want to know, people was asking, well, can I put my house in a trust? We're going to get to that, but I'm going to run over this little information about what is a secure party and a creditor. Simply put, it is separating your living man or woman self from the all capital letters trademark, trade name, birth certificate, legal name, and protecting the assets and collateral of that name by backdating a security agreement to your 18th birthday. This creates you as a secured party, a lien holder over that name, therefore protecting this asset from lien, levy, seizure, garnishment, or forfeiture because of the fraud of the legal name trickery that you were unaware of until now. And fraud does void all contracts if the party being defrauded takes administrative action to call out the fraud. Now you have an effect cancel the disastrous effects of those contracts in your life that were done without your consent or your best interest at heart. Now, that's a mouthful. But as you keep reading, I'm sure we all see high levels of fraud, corruption taking place every day, bringing the growing number of people that are learning about secured party and creditor filings processes. It is important to understand that becoming a secured party creditor doesn't mean that you just file a U1 and you're done, which is sort of a common conception. You must be very mature in your studies as you will be tested again and again in your or sovereignty. The same agencies that are feeling threatened are also very much aware that most people doing the so-called secure party creditor filings understand very little about the correct process of establishing a secure party status and maintaining that status and living as both a private citizen and the trustee of a domestic public trust vessel that contracts and operates in the public and in commerce. Secure party creditor over the trade name Strawman. We must first understand that all functions through our trade name are Strawman. The trade name is your business and you as the living being function in commerce through your trade name. However, you are not the same as the trade name. This is one of the main purposes of establishing ourselves as a secure party. We must between the live being and the trade name of Strawman. Another purpose of the secure party creditor filing is to aid in the protection of all assets held in the estate, which is held by the trade name. The estate encompasses establish what the trade name is. We must use a UCC-1 filing. A secure party is one who holds an interest in a company's assets. They will record this asset, this interest in the public records by filing a UCC-1 financial statement. So if trade name is a business and we as a living being hold an interest in the estate of the trade name, we must file a UCC-1 financial statement to give notice to the public that we have a lien, all property, we have a liened all property pertaining to the trade name. It is important to remember that the UCC-1 itself is not the lien. It is only notice of the lien. The lien itself is established by a security agreement between the secure party and the debtor trade name. The security agreement is a private agreement with the specific that the debtor must perform transmitting utility for the secure party in commerce in exchange for the secure party providing assets and collateral to the debtor. This agreement would also specify a sum of typically $100 billion in the security interest from the debtor to the secured party. The secured interest amount doesn't have to be $100 billion, but it should be high enough number to ensure that the secured party will always have the paramount claim of interest for all assets and property of the debtor or trade name. To help you understand more, look at the secured party definition and other related terms in the Law Dictionary. Law Cornell Education, or other related good researching sites. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. I'm not going to go over the whole thing with you. This document is just part and parcel of what comes along with our secure party and creditor packages. We have these packages available to you at thehawkerdataelimination.org. Contact me, and we'll get you hooked up, and we'll guide you along once you get those materials so you can do this thing right. You can take control of your assets and stuff, and we are talking about your estate and establishing your trust tonight. Okay, and this is all part of it, and I want you because a lot of people don't look at this as being part of what they're doing. They say, "Well, I'm gonna do a will, and that's it." Nothing about no security interest. No, we just do it right. But nevertheless, we're gonna go with your trust. So y'all hold on a minute. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Michael Ruger. I'm the managing partner at Greenbush Financial Group, and today we're going to be discussing, should you consider putting your house in a trust? We actually have this conversation a lot with our financial planning clients, and most people think as soon as they hear the word trust, that's just for the uber wealthy. My last name isn't Rockefeller, so I'm never going to need a trust, but that's actually not true. Trusts have a lot of benefits that average families, average individuals should really consider accessing for events down the road. But I'll first start off in the most simple for people that aren't familiar with trust. What is a trust? Like, a trust is essentially you're setting up a third party, a fictitious third party, to own your assets. Sometimes that third party even has its own social security number, which is called a tax ID number. So it's like we're setting it up, and I'll go through why you would do that and what the benefits are. So there's really two types of trusts, and this is very important. There's revocable trusts, and then there's irrevocable trusts. So the main difference between the two is revocable trusts give you more flexibility because you're not really giving the asset away. You can always take that asset back. Versus an irrevocable trust, as the name suggests, you're making an irrevocable, non-reversible gift to this trust that you're not supposed to be able to take back to you. And each trust has different types of benefits that we'll be discussing today. So let's first start with a revocable trust. This is the most flexible one. Now, revocable trust, why would you want to set one up? The primary reason people set up these trusts is to avoid probate. Now, if anyone's ever had a family member or friend pass away and you've been the executor of their estate, you realize that probate is a huge headache. There's a lot of costs. There's a ton of paperwork. So to avoid that, any asset that's owned by a trust, there is no probate. Because when you go through the probate process, it's like you got to pay attorneys, you got to pay accountants, you might have to pay an appraiser. It's a court-driven process, so you got to deal with the courts. So if I own my house and I just want it to go to my kids, essentially if it's just in my will and I will it to them, that's going to go through the probate process. So my kids might not take ownership of that house for 6 to 12 months while it's going through the probate process. Versus if I have a revocable trust own the house, my kids can take immediate access to that thing as soon as they look at the trust document and say, oh, it belongs to the kids. There's no probate issue. Here you go. And it saves all the costs that you would have had to go through during the probate process. So a big benefit there. The other reason why people set up these revocable trusts is they have kids under the age of 25. So when you have younger children, if we have, you know, a house, we have retirement accounts, we have insurance. If God forbid something happens to me and my wife simultaneously and we have young children, what essentially happens is those assets get set aside for the kids, but then when they turn 18, they have full access, which means they could come into large sums of money and they might not make the best financial decisions at the age 18. They might decide not to go to college, or they might make some questionable life choices because they're just flush with cash. Now, to prevent that, what people will do is set up these revocable trusts to say, if and in that instance that happens, where something happens to both parents, that says all the money goes into this trust, but then it's only going to get released in accordance with the language in the trust document. So I might say my trust document, you know, if that happens, money can always be spent for education, health, normal living expenses, but the principal of that trust will not be released until they get a third at 25, a third at age 30, and a third at age 35. You can set these up however you want. They're completely custom and everyone has different wishes. But just knowing it's a way to kind of control those assets if you have younger children in the family. So that's really revocable trust. So let's kind of shift gears over to the irrevocable trust. Now this is the trust where you're giving assets. So why would someone subject themselves to more restrictions? Now the two, and revocable trusts have all the benefits of an irrevocable trust. So you avoid probate, you can control it for younger children, but it has two added benefits. So the one benefit is it protects assets from a long-term care event. And the other one is it shrinks your estate. Now, shrinking your estate, that is for the uber wealthy that say, hey, I've got a $20 million estate and I'm going to have a huge estate tax. So if I give money to this trust, I'm essentially removing it and shrinking my estate. Now, since most of us don't have that issue, really it's the first one that kind of says, I want to protect assets from a long-term care event. Now, again, if you've ever had a family member that's had a long-term care event, whether they've needed home health aides, they've been in a nursing home, assisted living, you know that care is very, very, very expensive. And the way the system works now is you're essentially required to spend through all of almost all your assets, and then when you're well below the poverty level, then Medicaid will start paying for your care on your own. Now, with some advanced planning, using an irrevocable trust, you can protect a lot of your assets that should that long-term care event happen down the road, you don't have to spend down all of your assets. So that's like, I always ask clients, you know, you work so hard to build these retirement accounts, pay off your house and everything. Do you want those assets to go to your kids or your beneficiaries, or do you want it to go towards your care or Medicaid when they take it down the road if there's a long-term care event? And most people say, I want it to go to my kids. Well, this is a way with a little bit of advanced planning, you can ensure that those assets do. Because the way Medicaid works is, if you have a long-term care event, they have what's called a five-year look-back period. So they look back 5 years to say, if you gifted any of your assets away, if you gifted it to a trust, an individual, anything, it's back on the table like it never happened. Because what Medicaid does not want to have happen is you have a long-term care event, and then you gift all your assets to a trust and say, hey, I qualify for Medicaid, start paying for me. That's not what it's set up to do. The reason why there is that advanced planning is if you want to do this, you have to put these assets in the irrevocable trust. It has to make it by the five-year look-back period. Once you're past the 5 years, if there's a long-term care event, they can't look at those assets as a spend-down because they haven't been yours for more than 5 years. Now, people say, well, I've heard your house with Medicaid, they can't make you sell it. It's not a countable asset. You know, to an extent, that is accurate, that it's not a countable asset. If all you own is your house and you've spent through all of your other assets, you will qualify for Medicaid. However, what people do not realize is Medicaid puts a lien against that house. While they can't make you sell it while you're still living, they put a lien against it that says, listen, if we paid out $150,000 for you for your long-term care, when you pass, we're going to make you sell that house and we're going to recoup that money. So again, in the situation saying, I want my house to go to the kids, people don't realize that you didn't have to sell it, you qualified for Medicaid, but Medicaid is waiting to take that house as soon as you pass. If you have the house owned by an irrevocable trust and it's been in there for 5 years, they can't touch it. It's going to go to your kids, which is usually a more ideal situation. So when you look at that, for the amount it may cost to set up a trust, if an attorney charges you $2,000 or $3,000, which sounds like a lot of money, well, how much is it for your house, the value of your house, to make sure it's passing to your kids or to protect assets against a long-term care event, which is very expensive? I mean, it's not uncommon for nursing homes to cost upward of $120,000 plus per year. So again, a little advanced planning going a long ways. Now, I do get some questions, and these kind of came in from our blog and the website that I did want to go over, so that were very good questions. So when you give your house to a trust, the question was, okay, I have a STAR exemption, or I have an enhanced STAR, which reduced my property taxes. Do I still receive that if the house is owned by an irrevocable or irrevocable trust? And the answer is yes. So usually the estate attorney will put enough language in there that says any of the tax benefits you are getting as an individual will pass through to the trust even though it's owned there. The other question that was a good one is, if my house is gifted to a trust, do my beneficiaries still receive a step-up in basis? Because if you own assets as an individual, so if I buy my house for $20,000 40 years ago, but now it's worth $250,000, when I pass, if it's owned by an individual, you get a step-up in basis, which means when my beneficiaries get the house, they pay no tax on that. It's the same thing where if the attorney is putting the right language in the trust document, you should still be able to maintain that step-up in basis so your beneficiaries don't have to pay tax on the gain, which is a big deal because a lot of people that have owned their house for a long time have that gain built up in their primary residence. Here's the other big one. So if I sell my primary residence while I'm still alive, so I put my house in an irrevocable trust when I'm 70, and then I decide at 75, hey, I'm going to leave New York and go move to Florida, and I've had it in the trust for more than 5 years, is there an issue with me buying another house since I transferred the ownership? And the answer is no. There's no issue. If the irrevocable trust owns my house here, the irrevocable trust will sell the house and then buy my next house. Now, here's the number one mistake that we see people make in these real estate transactions. So there's a lot of stuff going on at these closings. We've seen it happen where someone will own a house in an irrevocable trust. They'll have satisfied the 5-year look-back period. They sell their house and the intended to have the trust to buy the new house. But at the closing, they make the check payable to the person, the owner. The owner then takes that check, they put it in their checking account, and then deposit the money back to an account that's owned by the trust. You now have to satisfy a new 5-year look-back period because you took ownership of those assets even for a second. So what you have to make sure is at that closing check should be made payable to the name of your trust, and then you immediately take that check and deposit it to either a checking account or an investment account that's owned by the trust, or you take that money and then your trust buys the next house at the next closing. Make sure it never leaves the trust. Otherwise, you voided everything you've gained in the last 5-year look-back period, and you have to start over again. So that's very, very important. Another question we get is, does the trust need to file a tax return? Revocable trusts do not have to file their own tax return because it's built in your Social Security number of the grantor or the owner. So there's no additional tax return needed. Irrevocable trusts may have to file their own tax return. If the only thing in that irrevocable trust is your primary residence, it's usually not income producing. So it has no income, so it doesn't have to file a tax return. However, as soon as you sell that house, if you sell the house and then you take the money and you put it in an investment account or you put it in a checking account and there's interest that has to be reported as taxable income, then your irrevocable trust under the tax ID will have to file its own tax return. So for those years forward, you file a tax return for yourself and your trust. So that'll be something you'll have to consider. Now, going back to a point I made earlier, are irrevocable trusts, is there any way to break them if you need to get to assets? Say there's some unforeseen event. And that's what kind of shies people away sometimes from the irrevocable, because it feels like I'm never going to be able to get these assets back. And I can tell you there's ways that the estate attorneys use to kind of get away or get around those barriers. And one of the ways is give money to an irrevocable trust. Let's just say it's sitting in an investment account now and I need to take $50,000 back, but I can't because I gave it away. What those trusts can do is they can distribute or a lot of times gift money to the beneficiaries. So if the beneficiaries are my kids, the trust can give money to the beneficiaries and then the beneficiaries gift the money back to me. So just kind of, it's like a family meeting saying, hey, we're setting this irrevocable trust to really protect the assets for you guys. If we need it, they're going to gift money to you and you're going to gift it back to me. That's okay. That's kind of a workaround because essentially they're making a gift to me. I'm not just taking my asset back. The other way is the trustees of your irrevocable trust can partially revoke some of the trusts. So we can look at the trust assets and say, we're going to partially revoke $50,000 to give those assets back to mom and dad. So there's definitely workarounds that says, you know, once you've given it, you know, there's creative ways to kind of get those assets back if needed. So how to establish the trust? So, okay, we've gone over the benefits, everything like that. How do I actually establish one of these things? You usually need an estate attorney to establish these because a trust is an actual document, and you have to outlay who's going to be the trustee, you know, what are the terms of the trust, who are the beneficiaries. A lot of times it mimics your will, because you'll have a will that says anything that's not owned by the trust is passing this way, but here's the trust document. A lot of times if, like, everything goes to my wife and then my kids, your trust document is going to say the same thing, but you might have some additional language in there for some of that stuff for the younger children, saying they only get assets at a later date. Now, the other question I get is, if I have a trust, do I even need a will anymore? Usually you need both, because there's always going to be some assets that are not owned by the trust. Like a car, like registering a car in the name of a trust is kind of a headache. So there's always going to be maybe some outlier assets that are owned by your estate that essentially you're going to need the will to speak to. Otherwise, you typically try and get as much as you can in the name of the trust to avoid probate. Hope this has been helpful. If you guys have any questions, feel free to reach out to me at moneysmartboard.com. Thank you.
Like I said, I hope this was helpful to you about whether you add your home to your trust. We'll cover as much of this information as I possibly can. We're going to another conversion break and a little music, and we'll be right back, and we'll continue, okay? Hold on a moment.
Hello, everybody. I want to introduce you to The Great Debate by Dr. Walter Williams. He single-handedly laid out the facts in this powerful debate against Mr. Munir Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, Chester Blair, a prominent lawyer in Chicago, Illinois, and Reverend Henry Hardy, a prominent minister in Chicago, and Prince Azio ben Israel of the Hebrew Israelites. This debate was hosted by a retired policeman named W.L. Lillard. Now, the whole thing was a setup by Lillard and his gang, but it didn't work. They brought what they believed to the table, but Dr. Walter Williams brought what he knew for a fact and what he could prove and laid it on the table. We are now in the age of knowing. The age of walking around believing this stuff is over. For your copy of The Great Debate, go to TahakaDataElimination.org. That's TahakaDataElimination.org, or contact me by phone. My number's on the website. Oh, and by the way, the lawyer got bust up too. The Great Debate, get your copy today. Good day and peace.
Okay, everybody, we're back. Now I'm going to continue on with this, what is a secured party and creditor. They say the filing of a UCC-1 is also important because it gives notice to all agencies, which means that no agency compelled the debtor to turn over any assets before first meeting $100 billion obligation to the secured party. This is how all assets of the trade name can be protected by the proper use of the secured party creditor process. However, it is important to remember that the government and its agencies can change their policies constantly, potentially change the way we achieve our remedies. Therefore, we must not be attached to the secure party creditor filing as the only way to achieve freedom forever. This process may and actually should evolve all of the policies governing commercial business evolve. Even though the agencies can change their policies at any time, whereby they change our manner of achieving our remedy, they can never actually take away our remedy. There must be always be a form of to achieve our remedy. We must have the continue to do our due diligence and learn to roll with the punches. Protecting assets is not the only thing that is accomplished through the secure party creditor process. We can also do what is referred to as securing our assets that are being held by the financial institutions and government agencies, such as loans, bonds, and tickets. Whenever we sign for something, such as when we sign a promissory note for a mortgage, what happens is that the banking institutions holds on to that asset, the liability side of the transaction, which is the obligation to pay. With the secure party creditor filing, we are placing ourselves in a position where we can either redeem our asset to close out the account, or we can discharge the debt to close out that account. With the House Joint Resolution 192 and Public Law 7310, we have our remedy to either redeem our assets or discharge our debt, but we must first have direct status established in commerce, since only secure parties can operate on the credit side of the transaction. Debtors can only operate the liability side and must pay their obligations. So by what authority does one have to establish oneself as a secure party creditor or of a trade? In commerce, it is the one who provides right against all assets of that corporation. In other words, when a baby has birth certificate issued against the flesh and blood body, the corporation is credited. But it is the child that in their for that corporation themselves as the secure party for the debtor trade name corporation, and thereby secure all assets and collateral pertaining to the trade name. When the certificate of live birth is issued, it is done so without any face value, similar to a blank check. You know it has value, you just don't identify the value until it is time to close out an account. We do this by sending an indemnity bond to attach to House Justice order, and one provide our credit to that order to the Treasury to be held in trust for the $100 billion. This bond is to be used to discharge our public debts. All of this is done in accordance with the Uniform Commercial Code provision. This process includes the security agreement, UCC filing, a chargeback order, and even a common law copyright if you choose to get one. It is important to remember that this is a simple outline of some components of the secure party creditor filing. You must do your own research to ensure your process is complete before moving forward with discharging debt and redeeming your asset. Okay, I hope you got that. That document comes along with our package too. What I would like to add also, if you all, if you got an account over there on Facebook, you can get a creditor group over there, and in the file section, there's a tremendous amount of information in those files that you can access. Right, that's Amana Bay secured Amana secured party and creditor group. Okay, right there on Facebook. Okay, we also on your other social sites and stuff. But nevertheless, we gonna move on, and let's go to our next segment, which is dealing with taxes when it comes to your trust and stuff. Okay, so y'all sit still. Taxation. Okay, hold on a minute.
Welcome back, everyone. Michael here with Offshore Citizen. Today I'm going to dive into a subject which is, you know, probably not going to get me the most views. It's probably not going to go viral or something like that, but I think is important for a certain group of people, and it's something that I see misconceptions about. In fact, I've seen some kind of schemes marketed which are not valid lately, and so I wanted to dive into it. And that is the subject of how trusts are taxed, okay? So we're going to dive into this quickly. Before we get into that, and I'll try to go through all the details for you, so again, stick around and tell me what you think at the end. Click the subscribe button if you haven't done so already. Click the notification bell. Really helps us out. Really appreciate it. You know, if you like our videos, please subscribe. Please check out more of them. Please share them with your friends. We really, you know, are trying to grow it and try to deliver you good information. So, and then if you're interested in this subject at all, that is to say asset protection, tax planning, banking, corporate structure formation, payment processing, residencies, citizenships, international investing, all that kind of stuff, then by all means, reach out to us. You can book a call with me, clarity.fm/Michael Rosmer. There's a link below. Or you can check out our websites, offshorecitizen.net, offshorecapitalist.com. Okay, let's go. So what is the situation when it comes to how trusts are taxed? So this is a little bit of a confusing thing for a lot of people, in part because of the fact that a trust, as I've talked about, you can check out some of our other videos where I kind of explain a little bit about how trusts work, but they're not necessarily a legal entity. It's more like a relationship between parties. They're sometimes treated as a legal entity, but it's not. A trust is not intrinsically, in a lot of parts of the world, a legal entity. In fact, in a lot of parts of the world, a trust is not recognized at all. And so this becomes fairly important in order to regard what taxation takes place. And so just to recap for you, in a trust, there are basically three meaningful roles, okay? There is the settlor or grantor, who is the person who sets up the trust and puts the assets in initially. There's the trustee, who holds those assets and manages them in trust for the purposes of the beneficiary, okay? Beneficiaries are the people where it ultimately goes to. Now, as you can see, because there's three people, you might think, okay, well, where is that taxable? Is it taxable at the beneficiary level? Is it taxable at the trustee level? Which is typically kind of, the trustee is the trust, right? When we're saying that, we're referring really to the trust because it's the trust assets usually are taxable, paying that out. Or is it at the settlor grantor level, okay? Now, this is a little bit interesting because of the fact that it depends on the way the trust is set up in most cases, okay? So let's use an example. If I put assets into trust and the trust is what's called revocable, meaning that I can basically undo the trust, I can take them back, then generally those assets are taxable to me, okay? I'm making some generalizations here. You have to look country by country. As I said, in some countries they don't have tax trusts, so then you have to kind of look at case law to figure out how it is that they're taxed, for instance, Spain, right? And we'll use Spain as an example as we go forward because it's kind of relevant. So that's one scenario, right? Another is we say, okay, it's irrevocable, meaning I'm putting the assets into trust, and okay, great, they're in trust. I can't take them out, right? Well, does that mean that they're still taxable to me? Does that mean that they are taxable to the trustee? Does it mean they're taxable to the beneficiary? How does that work, right? And now we start to get into the next part, which is, okay, do the assets clearly pay out some sort of a return to the beneficiaries directly, or do those assets accumulate in trust and then get distributed later, Okay, that's kind of the nature of it, and you might kind of go through the last part, which is, if you have multiple beneficiaries, is it clear, are they clearly divided between, say, three people, or is it that they're discretionary, like it can vary. It could be more to one and less to another and none to somebody else. Okay, those factors are, generally speaking, what we're going to look at when we pay attention to how it is that they're taxed. Okay, and the misnomer, the fallacy that I hear people talk about is they kind of have this idea that it's like, oh, hey, so long as it's not paid out, there's no taxable event. And that's very often not true. It might be true, right? But most of the time, a lot of the time, it's not true, okay? So here we go. There are typically two scenarios under which the grantor or the settlor would remain taxable, okay? The first is if it's a revocable trust, then typically it would remain taxable to the grantor or settlor. Not always, right? I don't want to, the reality is there's lots of countries in the world, right? Lots of ways that trusts can be interpreted. But generally speaking, in that scenario, it could be taxable to the grantor, okay? The next scenario is that under which it could be taxable to the grantor is if it is somehow deemed that a transfer has not taken place yet, okay? So I'm going to give you the example of Spain here. Spain, because there are no trusts in Spain, treats a trust like a partnership, okay? And so the key distinction in Spanish rules is they're trying to figure out when did the transfer take place. Basically what they do is they remove the trust, okay? So they basically just have the two parties, the grantor or the settlor and the beneficiaries. And they say, okay, when did the transfer actually take place? When the transfer took place, if it, you know, hasn't taken place yet, then it's taxable to the grantor settlor. If it has taken place, then it's taxable to the beneficiaries. And that's kind of the general idea if you go and read up on the case law about it, okay? All right, perfect. So that's the other scenario. Now, then we have the scenarios where you say, okay, great. What would often happen is that a trust, the transfer into a trust might be considered a gift. Okay, so we could use, for example, the U.S. rules, right? Under the U.S. rules, there's a certain, for an American or from U.S. citus, there is a lifetime limit on how much gifts can be given, okay? So typically, if I take that money as the grantor and I put it into trust, right? Let's just say it was $5 million, okay? And say I haven't used up my gift limit anywhere else. If it's just that principle that gets paid out to the beneficiaries, then there shouldn't be any tax. Why is that? Well, because that's after-tax money, okay? It's like I was giving you a gift. So the trust is basically controlling how long that takes, what the process is by which that happens, but it doesn't change the material nature of the transaction. So generally speaking, when we're looking at common law jurisdictions where they do have trusts, the characteristic of the income is maintained. Okay, so a trust kind of flows it through. So if, for instance, you have a capital gain that takes place, it's not like it goes in, whereas if it was a corporation has a capital gain, they realize the gain, then they pay out money, that's a dividend, or they pay out money as, say, a wage. The capital gains nature of it is not preserved. In this case, it is preserved. It flows through. Okay, so the trust holds a property, the property gets sold, that money flows through to the beneficiaries. The characteristic of it, which is capital gains income, flows through to the beneficiaries. Okay? Make sense? All right. Now, there's two scenarios that we can have here, right? The one scenario is we say, okay, let's start with, as I mentioned, the whole thing is, if it's just money has been put into trust, there's no gains, and it just gets paid out, then it's fairly clear, right? It's basically just a transfer from one to the other. So, you know, again, you can figure out, okay, when did it get transferred, but more or less it's just a transfer. Where we get into complications is when we put assets that grow into a trust, okay? So maybe I'm going to put in stocks, maybe I'm going to put in businesses, maybe I'm going to put in property, gold, maybe I'm going to put in cash, but then the cash is going to be used to buy these things, etc., right? So there's some sort of actual profitability that is happening within this trust, okay? All right, fair enough. So now there's gains. So now the question becomes, all right, what if those gains are paid straight out to the beneficiaries? Well, then generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, if they're immediately paid out to the beneficiaries, especially this will typically be determined by the rules of the trust, then in that scenario, it's going to be taxable to the beneficiaries, okay? The flip side is that you say, okay, it's not paid out immediately to the beneficiaries. It's kept in the corpus. It's basically added to the corpus of the trust, the corpus being kind of the body, the assets of the trust. In that case, it would typically be taxable at the trust level, okay? Now, what the consequences of this are is that potentially this could lead to some sort of a deferral arrangement, okay? And if that's the case, then sometimes you're going to end up in a situation where as those assets add up within the trust, when they do get distributed, they may still be taxable to the beneficiaries, okay? So this would be a really common thing. If we look at the anti-avoidance rules around trusts in Australia, there's quite, I guess, four or five anti-avoidance regimes related to these types of entities in Australia. And in those, there's almost no scenarios. There's basically one scenario under which you can defer, okay? If you defer under that scenario, then it's going to be taxable when it's received, okay? And then, you know, we can kind of deal with the other scenarios as they arise. So I just wanted to mention this to you because of the fact that it's noteworthy that in tax in general, like, income is going to get taxed. So usually the idea is if income has already been taxed, okay, at like a personal level, then a transfer often will have some sort of a limit under which it's not taxed. And we've talked about gift as a big exemption. And that's kind of why, right? If I receive money from my company, I pay all my tax on it, the company's paid their tax, then whether I give that money, like whether I'm spending that on somebody else or whether I'm spending it on myself, really doesn't matter, right? It's kind of immaterial. If we're in a situation where the tax has not been paid, right, then the fact that it flows from A to B to C, and it's not paid at B, then it's going to make sense that it's paid at C, right? The fallacy that some people seem to have is they seem to have this idea that it's like, oh, hey, what about this part in the middle? In the part in the middle, hey, a trust, a lot of people seem to have some idea that trusts somehow aren't taxable. Most of the time, trusts function and have kind of a taxability on their own. So in the absence of some other taxability, a trust could be taxed. Now, of course, if you're in a jurisdiction with no tax, then that's not the case, right? So you have to dive into the specifics here. And so there is certainly some really good tax planning you can do where you can say, okay, great, there may be a foreign trust, and that trust is in a jurisdiction without tax consequences, and the assets are in a place that they're, you know, growing without tax consequences, and so, you know, you can defer there perpetually. It's also true that trusts are often used as charities, and so then the charity may not have tax consequences. Or there are some other specially designed trusts. We sometimes use this in U.S. domestic tax planning, where there's specific reasons why you're able to defer that income, and therefore there isn't tax until kind of the end event. So there are some cases like that, but generally speaking, the way that it works is there's not double tax. So this is like the difference, I would say, between a corporation, right? So a corporation receives the income, it pays tax, then it pays out a distribution after tax, right? And that after tax distribution then becomes taxable in the hands of the shareholder who receives it. In the case of a trust, the income flows in. It's not taxable. If it is taxable at the trust level, then it's not taxable usually at the beneficiary level. Whereas if it isn't taxable, or if it is taxable at the beneficiary level, then it's usually not taxable at the trust level. So again, designed to kind of flow through. So anyway, I hope that kind of gives a sense. I hope I was fairly clear there. If you have questions, please put them in the comments. If you like the video, please click the like button. I mean, click the subscribe button if you haven't done so already in general. I'm big on liking subscribers. Subscribers are great. You're wonderful. Anyway, if you want help with any of this kind of thing, please reach out to me, clarity.fm/Michael Rosmer. You can book a call with me. Check out our websites, offshorecitizen.net, offshorecapitalist.com. Share these things with anyone who might need some assistance. And
okay, everybody, we're back. Now, I want to go over another document with you, but I think we're getting down to an hour. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over this stuff with trust law, which, again, this time we'll go through in its entirety, and then we'll. But before we go there, we're going to take a quick break, and when I come back, we'll go over this trust law business. Okay, y'all. Hold on. Okay, we are back. Now let's go up here and let's deal with some of this this trust law, and let's make sure that we got this down to a science. This trust law. Y'all alone.
Hi guys, it's MJ, and in this video, I want to talk about trust. Now, trust, like a lot of things in finance, is a contract between various parties. But what makes a trust a little bit unique is the type of parties involved. So what I want to do to start the discussion is just start with the various parties involved in setting up a trust. First off, you have someone known as a settlor. Okay, the settlor, also sometimes known as the grantor, but basically this is the person who gives assets to the trust. So gives assets. To the trust, sometimes it could be, say, a parent. If we're setting up a trust for a child, the parent could say, give some assets to the trust. So they say, we're going to hold the house in a trust. Then we have another party known as the protector or the trustee. So the protector or trustee, they're the person who has to give consent before anything can happen, before any action can be taken place or something like that. So they give consent for action. Don't be too concerned about what their actual names are. Depending on what country you are, they will be different terms. But essentially, you have one party who's giving the assets. You have another party who looks after the assets or manages them. And then you have a third party, which is the one you actually want to be, and that is known as the beneficiary, the person who, you know, receives the distribution of the assets, receives distribution, and this person is known as the beneficiary. And yeah, like I said, that's basically what a trust is. It's a contract. A lot of things in finance, whether it be shares or bonds or all these things, they all are contracts, and they're a contract between various parties. In this case, instead of having an investor and a manager or a lender and the person who borrows the money, we have these three individuals, all three parties. It can be groups. I mean, it could be a bunch of children as beneficiaries, could be a group of people as the trustees or the protectors. But essentially, a trust is a contract between parties. And the idea is that there is some sort of asset at play. So what you have in your contract is you'll have, you know, the terms of the contract. So the terms of the contract or terms of the trust will determine what asset is, you know, is the trust holding, who the settlor is, who the protector is, who the beneficiary is. And there's a whole bunch of rules and regulations around what you can have in your trust and what you can't. Some rules are like the beneficiary has to already be born, so you can't say, I'm going to be leaving my house to my future grandchildren if you don't have any grandchildren yet or they haven't been born. But this very much depends on where you're living. Depending on what country you're in, they will have different rules and regulations around what you can and cannot say in the terms of the trust. I mean, we can also go into the types of trusts. I mean, the types of trusts, there are lots. If you are interested in the types, check out Wikipedia. They do have like the A to Z of all the various different trusts that you can get. Again, depending on what country you're in, that will determine the various different trusts that are available for you to set up. So now, why do people make a trust? You know, why do they go through this administrative burden of creating this contract between parties? And that's what I want to do for the rest of this video, is go through 10 purposes or 10 reasons for creating a trust. So let's go with our 10 reasons, and then after that you should have a good understanding and we can end the video. Because, I mean, yeah, the three things I think that make up a trust are the intention. Maybe let me write this down here. It's intention, which we're going to look at now, the 10 reasons, the subject matter, and the objects. You know, subject matter is like the terms of the trustee, and the objects are the assets. But let's look at the intentions. That's what I find the most interesting. So the 10 reasons. Number one is privacy. Okay, unlike, say, a public company where we see the word public, they have to disclose their financials, they have to say, you know, what they're doing, all that type of stuff. In some territories, trusts have a level of privacy. They can do things or manage assets in a way that does not need to be disclosed to the public, and some people like to be private or like to keep secrets, and that's one of the reasons for creating a trust. The other reason is quite a funny one, but it's for spendthrift children. So let's say I am a very rich and successful person, but I know that my daughter just loves shopping. She just loves buying every single shoe that comes on the market. She's got a big room of shoes. And I know that when I die, or even now, if I gave her unlimited access to my money, she's going to go ballistic. What I can do is I can create a trust. So I give all the assets, all my wealth to this trust. But then I set up a trustee to say that, okay, what we're going to do is we're only going to give her $1 million for shopping a month. You know, we're going to limit the amount of money that we give her a month so that she doesn't go and blow it all in one go. So it is a way to be a bit of a spendthrift. You hear a lot of jokes, oh, he's a trust fund baby. It's a kid who doesn't have to go to college and spends his life on a yacht drinking cocktails and, you know, partying with girls. That's what some trusts are set up for. to protect children who aren't financially sophisticated enough to deal with so much money. It might be a term, say, that once they reach age 21, they get full control or some sort of thing. It also is used in wills and estate planning. So normally when somebody dies, their money gets turned into some sort of trust where you have some beneficiaries and people can do all that type of stuff. But it might be beneficial to set up a trust before you die, because in some countries, we have something known as a death tax. So once you die, you have to spend a lot of money to the government because you've died. I mean, it's a completely bogus, stupid tax. I mean, like all taxes, it's all stupid. But the idea is that you pay this massive tax. Now, what happens is if you have this beautiful mansion in England, oh, look at this lovely manor house, you know, with the little trees and everything like that, and they say this is worth $100 million, okay, and you die. And that tax is now, let's say, 10% for sake reasons, so it's $10 million that you now owe the government. But you don't have £10 million or 10 million rand worth of cash just lying around. All you have, or all you've been left in the will, is this mansion. But now to try and sell this mansion for $100 million or its market value is going to take time, and the taxman is putting a lot of pressure on you. So some people end up selling this mansion for, say, $20 million, giving half to the taxman, and then just having $10 million and losing the family's estate. So what people do is they'll put the mansion before they die into a trust so that when they do die, they avoid the death tax. And that's the problem with tax, is that it can always be avoided, hence why there's all these extra regulations and tax rules, and it becomes this massive headache for everyone. But it's one of the ways is to set up a trust to avoid death tax. I mean, there is, so this is something that's been recently changed in South Africa, but another thing that people use trust for was tax planning. So listen to how dumb this was. What we had is that you got taxed at a certain rate if you received a certain amount of money. So I think in South Africa it's something around 40% at the highest income bracket. So you're making money, you're getting taxed at 40%. However, if you set up a trust and you put all your assets into the trust and you make yourself the beneficiary, or you make your kids or something like that, then the tax rules were like something like just 20%. So just by setting up a piece of paper, just setting up some sort of contract, some legal entity, you've saved yourself, you've halved your tax bill. And this undermines the whole thing of taxing. You know, the whole idea is, oh, we're going to tax the rich and feed the poor. But now, if the rich have got enough financial sophistication to set up these legal contracts or these trust documents, they could avoid tax and undermine the whole government socialist policies. So what governments do now is trusts are taxed at the maximum, which kind of defeats the purpose of having a trust for all these other reasons, and people now have to set up other types of special purpose vehicles, and it gets very, very confusing. But one of the reasons for setting up a trust was to beat the tax man at his own game. And sometimes it was done intentionally. Governments would say to the rich, look, we're going to put on this big tax for show. You know, that's why we're going to get people to vote for us. Yeah, oh, hate the rich. But don't worry, we'll have this little loophole for you guys where you can have your little trust and you don't actually have to pay that much tax. You know, but it's good marketing for us to see that we are punishing the rich for being rich. So it does get very, very political, and conspiracy theories can pop up around tax planning and trust and all that. Another one is around corporate structures. So when you start looking at financials of companies, you start getting quite confused, because not all the company is held within one legal entity. You know, there's a group holding, there's there's the charity trust, there's there's this. And what they use is they use trusts within corporate structures. It does make it quite complicated. That's why when you want to buy another company or there is a merger, it takes so long, it requires so many people, because trusts make it complicated. And the reason why they have these corporate structures is for some sort of tax planning. It is so that there can be some privacy. You know, they do use it for a bunch of reasons, but some corporations do use trusts in the structuring of their business. I mean, one of the big key reasons for also setting up a trust is asset protection. So what I can do is I can go and set up a trust and put a lot of my assets in this trust. then what I can do is I can engage in business activities or, you know, take up a loan and all that type of stuff. If my business fails and I have to be liquidated and I have to pay everybody back their money, the assets I put in the trust are protected. So they can come in, they can take my house, they can take my car, and I can turn around and say, no, you actually can't take the house because I don't own the house. The trust owns the house, and that's different from me. So I can go out all big, and I can hide collateral in a trust entity, and that way I can protect my assets from creditors and can make a bankrupt remote. This is very similar to how we see special purpose vehicles being used with securitization and credit-linked notes and all that other financial gibberish stuff that really does make the subject quite confusing to new time people. I mean, another reason for setting up a trust could be for, say, co-ownership. Co-ownership is kind of the idea, like, let's say you get married, you decide to put all your money together into a trust, or you buy a property with a friend. A trust could be a better vehicle than setting up a whole partnership agreement because it might have be a little bit more strict rules. But the whole idea is that trust can be used for co-ownerships. Another reason for setting up a trust is if you want to start a charity. You can say that the beneficiaries are the poor children in your town. You can give your assets. You can get people to be the protectors. And you can manage a charity to be through the whole trust structure. But again, it does depend on what country you are. Some countries might say, no, that's, you know, dodgy. Others might allow it. I mean, we do even see financial trusts being set up. And, I mean, a lot of people say, well, are these really trusts? But financial trusts, these are things like unit trusts, pension plans, remuneration trusts. This is when you set up a trust as some sort of investment vehicle. It gets around certain tax laws. It gets around certain regulations. It does get a little bit complicated. And like I said, it does very much depend on what country you're under, because each country might have its different rules and regulations around financial trusts. And then finally, you can set up a trust in some sort of service delivery industries. So what do I mean by that, service delivery? So let's say I am a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. I think in Canada they even have it with construction workers. But the idea is that I'm a lawyer. I want I'm going to help you out for your divorce or whatever you're going to do. You need to pay me legal fees. But I don't want to do the work and then you don't actually have the money to pay me. It's a waste of my time. You know, there's all this bad debt, counterparty risk, all that type of stuff. So what the lawyer will say is set up a trust. And then what you will do is you will pay the money into the trust. And then the lawyer will only take the money out of the trust as he does his work. Same with the construction person. If the lawyer then stops doing his work, you can then recall your money from the trust. It's some sort of mechanism to facilitate, you know, the payment of a service that's done over a long duration of time. But yeah, I mean, those are the 10 top reasons for setting up a trust. Depending on the rules and regulations, there might be other reasons to try and, you know, exploit loopholes and stuff like that. But essentially, a trust has got is a contract between three big parties. One's giving the assets, one controls them, and one benefits from them. And there we go. That is trust law. But like I said, it does change quite often. We've seen with South Africa, the tax planning has changed. And it is something that we could expect more changes to be made as more loopholes are exploited. But there we go. That's trust law. Thanks guys so much for watching. And yeah, hit subscribe and check out some more videos. I am busy making a whole bunch on regulation and all that. So if it is interesting you or it is something that you have to study for your test, make sure you watch the...
Okay, we're back. Now, there's one other thing that I want to deal with here tonight. This is another one of our documents. And it's how to handle yourself in the courtroom and the four rules that you can use inside the court. And it's all about knowing who you are. And I want to go over this. And it's coming from a document that we have. And it started off by saying, on our corporate government, no sovereign can lawfully be tried or convicted of any statutory crime. I recently discovered how to avoid prosecution under the trust when a sovereign is taken before a corporate prosecuting attorney or a judge. Okay, let's get down into this right here. Let's check this thing out here. Let me first of all, blow this up a little bit. It says first, the individual must inquire if we are on the record, and if not, insist upon it. Say nothing, sign nothing, and answer no questions until you are convinced that the proceedings are being recorded. Second, all an individual has to say for the record is, I am the beneficiary of the trust, and I am appointing you as my trustee. Talking to our judge. Thirdly, the sovereign then directs his trustee to do his bidding. As my trustee, I want you to discharge this matter I am accused of and eliminate the record. And fourth, if the individual suffered any damages as a result of his or her arrest, they can direct that the trust compensate them from the proceeds of the court by saying, I wish to be compensated for X amount of dollars in redemption. This statement is sufficient to remove the authority and jurisdiction from any proceedings, attorney or judge. The accused will immediately be released from custody with a check, a license, a claim he identifies as a damage. It doesn't matter what the action involves or how it is classified by the corporate law as a civil or criminal action, and it works every time. But anyway, this comes from a document that we have, and you can read the whole thing from start to finish. But I just want to run this part here by you to let you know that this stuff is available. And keep in mind, as I've stated before, you can go over to TahakaDataElimination.org and just take a look around over there and contact me. My number's at the top of the site. And we got a video page and all of our radio broadcast go straight to my widget is right there on that page at TahakaDataElimination.org. Okay, we're going to take do a little bit more music, and then we're going to come back and we're going to be closing this thing out. So y'all sit back and relax, and we'll be back at the Okay, sorry about that little delay, ladies and gentlemen. Y'all sit still for me.
algo más. Ella canta, yo no canto, yo te amo. Y ella baila, yo no bailo, yo te cuido. We'll be right back.
destroyed. The fact that you and I are working here today is evidence of that.
All right, everybody, we're back. Just had to step out there and check on this firework business is going on. Wow. Boy, they lighting up America out there with fireworks. And if I'm not mistaken, I think I hear a little gunfire. So they still shooting guns. And a reminder, today is the 3rd. But I guess it's getting close to the 4th. So these folks around here, they can't own. I want to let everybody know that we will be coming back next week with another podcast where we can start teaching some of this stuff and letting people know how they can do a lot of things when it comes to law and being able to exercise some sort of freedom and get out from under this tyranny and stuff that's going on. So we'll be laying this information out for you. Keep in mind, don't forget that about your secure party and creditor thing. Don't forget that. That is vital for you to have, especially at this day and age. Things are getting rough out there. And we got to learn this stuff, and not only do we have to learn it, we're going to have to get in the habit of actually practicing this stuff, okay? Y'all hold on a minute. Let me run this in one more time.
What a fantastic way to live. Hello, I'm Tahaka Amana L. Bay, operating in the private as a secured party and creditor instead of living the life of a debtor. Now to learn how to do that, you have to get the knowledge. There's no doubt about it. You don't mix public with private, just like oil and water don't mix. For the skill and know-how, go to www.TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Contact me, Tahaka. My number is on the website. Or send me an email. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Learn how to live the good life as a secured party and a creditor instead of a debtor, and eliminate your debts. Fun time is almost over. TahakaDebtElimination.org. Peace. Credit card debt, student loan debt, lawsuits, child support, mortgages, foreclosure, secured party and creditor. Get my free report. Go to www.TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. What kind of trust do you set up? How do you use a trust? What do you put in a trust? For the solution, contact me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. Get my free report by going to TahakaDebtElimination.org. Driver's license, freedom to travel. Who exactly needs the driver's license? What did the U.S. Supreme Court rule about it over and over again? How does that work? What is proper syntax grammar? Get my free report. Go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. Fill out the little contact form. Put your email address in there. That'll come straight to me, and I'll rush it directly to you. Email, TahakaDebtElimination.org.
All right, now we're going to let this guy run across this stuff about your bills being prepaid. Boy, he was excited. Excuse me. About this thing. So y'all on me.
So your Social Security card is connected to an account, a trust at the Federal Reserve that has millions, houses, millions of dollars that belongs to you. Now it's illegal to go grab cash out of there, but what these lenders do is they take your open-end credit plan, which you just discussed, which is your Social Security card, right, and they take money from there. So every time you go buy something, it's already paid for by you. That's why you're not a borrower, you're an original creditor. And they loan it back to you. I'll prove it to you. This is a contract for a car that was financed. Let's see. On Section C, they talk about security interest. If you have a car, everybody please, go grab your contract, you know, the big yellow thing they give you, and they try to make it damn near invisible so you can't read it if you don't notice that.
Right.
They don't notice kind of stuff.
Right.
They talk about security interest. If you look at the bottom of there, they try to change the wording up a little bit, but if you look at the bottom, it says security interest secure all obligations. What does that mean? That means before I pulled this car off the lot, it was paid for already. Who the hell paid for the car? Nobody's that nice to me. You paid
right.
for it already. Right? So a lot of people don't know that. So they think that these lenders, they're not lenders. You're the original creditor and the consumer. So that's what makes you so powerful, right? So I just proved that, and I'm a further proof right now. So let's see. If you look at a utility bill, you look at your car note, you look at your mortgage. Let me say this. All right, man, I'll borrow $1,000 from you.
Okay.
Right? Am I in the negative or positive with you?
You are in the negative.
Genius, right? Okay, so I can pay on a negative balance. Correct?
But
if I don't owe you $1,000, I'm just giving you money. Am I paying on anything?
No.
I can't pay on something that's in the positive. That's just a gift.
Right.
So look at your car note, look at your utility bills, look at your insurance. It's all in the positive. Why is that? Paid for already.
Right.
Look at it. If you pull your car up now, so I'll tell you, if I owe $1,000 a month, okay, $1,000 in the positive, because it's paid for. You're just giving them money at this point. It's paid for already.
Right.
The only time you see something coming in negative where, let's say I move to a new place and my credit's not all right, and I get I need utilities, so I go get a light bill, right? I get the light bill. They're going to say, hey, you need to put a deposit down. So I put $120 down. They say, if you pay on time for 12 months, we'll give you the $120 back. Right, so I paid for 12 months. Mind you, the whole time the utility bill's in the positive because it's paid for already. Then at the end of the month, I mean, the end of that year, when they pay me that money back, that's in a negative because they owe me now. That's
right.
The only time you see something kind of negative.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Got you.
So keep that in mind. We're consumers. We're original creditors. Right? And every bill is in a positive for a reason. Why? Because it's paid for already by you. Security interest secured all obligations.
Wow. So this boy came here down to
a Social Security card.
And this is what I've been trying to tell everybody. You can go to YouTube and bring up a lady called Mary Croft. And she's got 11 videos over there with Red Ice Creation. And she explained this thing. You're the one providing all the credit. Everything is prepaid. When you sign for your house, you give them your signature, you give them your social security number, the house paid for. But you got to do the documents and get that stuff and get a clear and concise understanding of what you're doing when you try to do this stuff. And this is what we teach you how to do at Tahaka Debt Elimination. Once you get your package over there, you got access to the documents and stuff, and you can read this stuff for yourself. And we're there to answer questions for you and to guide you along. And we do this by email and by phone for those who live in other states across the country and other parts of the world. But anyway, that's TahakaDebtElimination.org. And you want to get our secure party and creditor package. Now, if you go to TahakaDebtElimination.org, you can put your email address in the Contact Us box. And we'll bring you our free report right to your email address. And you get a chance to look at some of these documents and look over, read them, and make a decision whether you're going to keep living the way you're living or whether you're going to get on into the private and start living a good life and start discharging these debts and start accessing your direct treasury account and being able to make some good, solid life changes for yourself and for your family. These remedies are available to you. They've been there for years, but a lot of people just simply didn't know about them. But here we are today making this information available to you so that you can change your life. And it is without a doubt a life-changing experience when you do this stuff and you're able to get the vehicles you want, get the home you want, and live the lifestyle that you were born to live. And so it's totally left up to you. Just go to TahakaDebtElimination.org. That's TahakaDebtElimination.org. Contact me, Tahaka Montiel Bay, and we'll get you straightened out, and then you can go on and live the good life. But nevertheless, I've been your host, Tahaka Montiel Bay, and keep in mind, that we are going to have other teaching segments that will be coming on, and we'll be bringing other guests and stuff on through the month, because we've switched things around, and Dr. Williams will be back with us, okay? Don't forget that. Dr. Williams will be back with you, with us. But anyway, I'm going to end this broadcast, and we'll see y'all next time. Y'all have a good night.